Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Exculpatory Evidence and Reasonable Probability Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 29, 2017, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Turner v. United States, which was consolidated with Overton v. United States. In 1984, the body of Catherine Fuller was discovered in an alley after she had been beaten and raped. Sufficient physical evidence to identify the perpetrators was not recovered, and the medical examiner could not determine the number of attackers involved. 13 teenagers were initially indicted for being involved in a group effort to originally rob and subsequently assault and kill her. Two of them, Harry Bennett and Calvin Alston, pled guilty and agreed to testify, but the details in their accounts differed. Turner and nine other defendants were found guilty by a jury, and their convictions were affirmed on direct appeal. Nearly 25 years later, Turner and several of the other original defendants moved to have their sentences vacated, claiming that they had not received fair trials because the government had withheld exculpatory evidence in violation of Brady v. Maryland. They also argued that newly discovered evidence, including the recantations of Bennett and Alston, established that they were actually innocent of the crime. The trial court denied the motion, and the District of Columbia Court of Appeals affirmed. The court held that the defendants had not shown a reasonable probability that the outcome of their trials would have been different with the new sentence. The question now before the Supreme Court is whether the petitioner's convictions must be set aside under Brady v. Maryland. To discuss the case, we have Brian Lichter, who is an associate at Latham & Watkins. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Lichter.
In the consolidated cases of Turner et al. V. United States and Overton v. United States, the petitioners are seven of eight defendants, the eighth died in prison, who are found guilty of brutally robbing, sodomizing, and murdering a woman named Catherine Fuller in a garage off of an alley in the H Street Northeast neighborhood of Washington, D.C. on October 1, 1984. At trial, the government presented evidence that this crime was committed by a large group of individuals. 10 defendants who were charged, and 2 cooperating witnesses who had pleaded guilty. The government's case was based largely on the testimony of the 2 cooperating witnesses and other individuals who identified the defendants near the scene of the crime. The government did not present any physical evidence linking the petitioner defendants to the crime. The jury convicted 6 defendants, acquitted 2, and claimed it was deadlocked on an additional 2 defendants, Christopher Turner and Russell Overton, who filed a separate brief before the Supreme Court. The trial court instructed the jury to keep deliberating, and after an additional 40 to 50 votes, the jury found Turner and Overton guilty as well. In 2001, 16 years after petitioners were convicted, a Washington Post reporter published an article identifying flaws in the prosecution's case, including the fact that the prosecution had not disclosed evidence of a possible alternative suspect. Several witnesses subsequently gave statements recanting their trial testimony. As a result, in 2010, petitioners filed motions to vacate their convictions or, in the alternative, for new trials. The petitioners argued that they were entitled to relief under Washington, D.C.'s Innocence Protection Act and that the prosecution had failed to disclose exculpatory evidence, as required by the Supreme Court's 1963 decision in Brady v. Maryland. Grounded in the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause, the Supreme Court's decision in Brady requires a prosecutor to turn over to a defendant all exculpatory evidence, that is, all evidence that exonerates or may tend to exonerate the defendant. In the 1972 case of Giglio v. United States, the Supreme Court extended its holding in Brady to require prosecutors to produce to defendants all evidence that may be used to impeach a government witness. In order to prove that the prosecution improperly withheld evidence that should have been disclosed under Brady, a defendant must make 3 showings. First, that the evidence was exculpatory. Second, that the prosecution did not disclose the evidence. Whether the non-disclosure was done in bad faith or was inadvertent is not relevant to the inquiry. And third, that the evidence was material, meaning that there is any reasonable likelihood it could have affected the judgment of the jury. The D.C. Superior Court, in evaluating the petitioner's claim for relief, found that the evidence was not material and denied the requested relief. The D.C. Court of Appeals affirmed. The petitioners sought certiorari regarding the appropriate standard for considering the materiality of withheld evidence under Brady and whether information arising after trial may be considered in evaluating the materiality of undisclosed evidence. The court, however, granted cert on only one straightforward question: whether petitioner's conviction should be set aside under Brady. Given the nature of this question, these consolidated cases are unlike most that come before the court. They are primarily focused on the facts. In this case, specifically, what evidence was not disclosed and how a jury would have viewed that evidence, rather than on a disputed question of law. Oral argument confirmed this. The justice's questioning focused on the nature of the evidence at issue, not the legal standards applicable to a Brady claim. So let's go through the evidence the petitioner's claim was improperly withheld and examine the arguments as to whether that information was material. Broadly speaking, the evidence at issue relates to two separate and unrelated individuals who were identified as committing the attack and impeachment evidence of a key government witness in the case against Russell Overton. The first set of undisclosed evidence could have been used to argue that an individual named James McMillan committed the attack with only one or two other accomplices. Specifically, as part of the post-conviction proceedings, the government produced to petitioners notes made by the lead prosecutor and the police department's master file. Prior to trial, the government told defendants that William Freeman, a street vendor who found the victim's body after the crime, had seen two men in the alley while he was waiting for the police to arrive, that one of those men, quote, appeared to have something in his coat, end quotes, and that the two men ran away when the police arrived. The evidence produced in the post-conviction proceedings revealed that Freeman had identified one of those men as James McMillan, whose identity was not disclosed to petitioners during their original trial. Discovery in the post-conviction action also showed that two other witnesses said they had seen McMillan at the crime scene shortly before the police arrived. Again, this is information the government did not disclose during the trial. There is a third piece of related evidence that the government also failed to disclose. Three witnesses told police that at around 5:30 p.m. on the day of Ms. Fuller's murder, they were walking past the garage where the crime occurred, that both doors to the garage were shut, and that they heard groaning coming from inside. William Freeman, the individual who discovered the victim, didn't find her until 6 p.m., and when he did, one of the doors to the garage was open. Whether the doors to the garage were open or shut is significant because all parties agreed that, given the layout of the garage and where the crime allegedly occurred, 10 assailants could not have fit in the garage if both doors were shut. Taken together, the defendants at trial could have used this evidence to suggest that McMillan and one or two other accomplices committed the crime at around 5:30 p.m. and that the witnesses who were walking through the alley at that time and heard groans actually heard the crime occurring. Petitioners also suggested that the object McMillan was seen hiding in his coat might have been the object, likely a pipe, that was used to sodomize the victim, as the police never recovered this object. Also significant is the fact that prior to the trial in this case, McMillan pleaded guilty to robbing and assaulting two middle-aged women, the victim here was also middle-aged, in the same neighborhood where this crime occurred. And, in 1992, McMillan pleaded guilty to brutally robbing, sodomizing, physically assaulting, and nearly killing another woman in the same 8th Street Northeast neighborhood in a crime very similar to this one. The petitioners argued that all of this evidence was highly material, would have allowed them to pursue an entirely separate line of defense, and would have altered the jury's verdict. Specifically, at trial, each defendant essentially conceded that the attack was a large-scale group attack, but argued that he did not participate in the attack. Using the McMillan evidence, however, the petitioners could have put forward an alternative theory of the crime, that James McMillan and his one or two accomplices were the perpetrators. Petitioners argued that this claim would have been bolstered by the fact that McMillan had pleaded guilty to two similar crimes by the time of trial, and they also argued that evidence of the 1992 assault would be highly probative at any retrial. In response, the government conceded that the evidence was exculpatory. It argued, however, that the evidence was not material. First, the government argued that the McMillan evidence did not place him in the alley at the time of the attack, only afterwards. And they argued that there was no direct evidence of McMillan actually committing the crime. The government also argued that given the brutality of the attack, the victim would not have groaned in response, and thus it is implausible that the witnesses walking down the alley actually heard the crime occurring. Finally, the McMillan theory required convincing the jury that the attack was committed by one to three people, and the government argued this evidence would not have been persuasive because it was countered by numerous witnesses who testified that the attack was carried out by a much larger group. A particularly interesting issue arises with respect to the evidence of the very similar crime McMillan committed in 1992. The government argued that evidence of this crime was irrelevant to the Brady analysis because the crime occurred several years after the original trial and therefore would not have been presented to the jury. Petitioners, however, claimed that this evidence would be admissible and highly relevant in any retrial, and that materiality for purposes of Brady should be viewed through the lens of how the retrial would proceed, an interesting proposition that the court has not previously addressed. However, oral argument did not address whether this new crime, is relevant to the Brady analysis, and the court seems unlikely to rule on this specific issue, even though it is an interesting question to ponder. The second piece of evidence that petitioners relied on relates to another alternative suspect, a man named James Blue. Petitioners developed the evidence related to James Blue through documents obtained by the Washington Post when it published its article in 2001. These documents showed that in October of 1984, a woman named Amy Davis told the police that she and a friend witnessed an individual named James Blue commit the crime. The police didn't take any action regarding this statement until August of 1985, approximately 9 months later, supposedly because the initial police report of Davis's statement was lost or misplaced. At that point, in August of 1985, the lead prosecutor interviewed Davis. A week before trial began, however, Blue murdered Davis, resulting from an argument over an unrelated dispute of money. The petitioners argued that the Blue evidence was material for two reasons. First, because the statement of Amy Davis was lost for 9 months, the petitioners argued they could have used this to cast doubt on the integrity of the police investigation. Overton specifically relied on the evidence more heavily in his separate brief. He claimed that the timely disclosure of this statement would have allowed the defense to interview Davis before she was murdered and to identify her friend, whom Davis had identified to the police only by her nickname. The defense could have then used that information to develop admissible evidence at trial and another theory of an alternative perpetrator. The government argued that this evidence was not material. First, the government argued that Davis was not alive at the time of trial, so her statement was not admissible. The government also claimed it was entirely speculative that the petitioners would have been able to identify Davis's friend and develop admissible evidence. Moreover, Davis had previously accused Blue of a different murder and lied to a grand jury about it. The lead prosecutor, as a result, did not find Davis credible, and the government argued that a jury similarly would not have credited her testimony. The final set of undisclosed evidence related to information that could have been used to impeach a government witness named Carrie Ellaby. At trial, there were only three witnesses who directly identified petitioner Russell Overton as participating in the attack: the two cooperators who pled guilty and Carrie Ellaby. The prosecutor's notes, which were disclosed during post-conviction discovery, revealed that Ellaby had asked a friend to lie to police about the attack, information that was not disclosed to the defense at the time of the original trial. In his brief, Overton argued that the two cooperators who testified against him at trial were not credited by the jury. Specifically, the jury acquitted two defendants, and the only evidence placing those two defendants at the crime scene was the testimony of the two cooperators. Thus, Overton argued that these acquittals showed the jury did not believe the testimony of the cooperators, and that his conviction must necessarily have been based on the testimony only of Ellaby. Overton argued, therefore, that any additional impeachment evidence against Ellaby would have been highly material, particularly with respect to this evidence, which showed that Ellaby had asked another witness to lie. The government countered, largely by arguing that there was already significant impeachment evidence against Ellaby, specifically that she herself had lied to police and was high on narcotics when she met with police for the first time. Therefore, the government argued any additional impeachment evidence would have been cumulative. Ultimately, given its factual nature, these consolidated cases are unlikely to have any major impact on the legal landscape surrounding Brady and its progeny. Although, if the court does rule for the petitioners, as many people expect it will, this ruling may cause lower courts to adopt the slightly more lenient standard in analyzing the materiality of Brady claims, focusing more on whether the undisclosed evidence could have impacted a jury's verdict, not the more difficult determination of whether that evidence would have impacted the jury's verdict. Ultimately, it will be interesting to see how the court rules.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.fedsoc.org/multimedia.